Okay. All right, so we're going to switch gears and talk about natural heterogeneity currently in the Earth. And we're going to show you some examples of using deep focus earthquakes to try to image these. So I have three field sites that I want to talk to you about, but I think I'm only going to get through two because of the number of questions, so that's perfectly fine. So please ask questions. I don't have to go through all of these. But I'm going to start looking at some structure beneath the Clabrian Arc in Italy, and then go to Morocco and Spain, and then very unlikely to cover some new work in the Banda Arc in Indonesia. So over the last couple weeks, I've been motivated to talk about slab tears, mostly because many or almost all of the geodynamicists have been talking about slab tears and their models showing the tearing of slabs. And most of their inferences from their models have also been motivated or maybe even partially constrained by seismic tomography. And so these are four examples in no particular order, and not because they're my favorite or anything, just a few images of cartoons of ideas that people think of slab tears in a couple of different scenarios. So this is a generic one talking about slab tears called step faults, mostly motivated by images of seismic tomography in the Mediterranean. Here is a very recent one beneath the slab beneath Chile. And then here is one beneath Colombia. So this is the Nazca slab here, and then this slab tear here. And then finally, one beneath Italy as well. And this is one that I was involved in about 10 years ago, looking at the subducted slab structure beneath Italy. And so in this cartoon, you can barely see the boot of Italy. And then this is Sicily located here. So I'm going to first talk about this Sicily. And so this was old work from about 10 years ago looking at seismic tomography, and I'm going to kind of show you the things that I've been working on since that I hope give us some more information about slab structure and heterogeneity in the mantle. Okay, so this is an older model of P-wave tomography beneath Italy, but I think it's still a really good one, and I continue to use it. So you'll see a very faint line of the coastline of Italy here. So here's the boot, and here's Sicily. North is in this direction here, and this is the ANU typical tomography color scale, where the cyan colors are fast and the browns are slow. And just for a historical note, we almost all of us use this because Brian Kennett is colorblind and he can see this. That's why. And I had classmates when I was a student there that used to call this the moldy bread scale. But anyway, so it's not blue-eyed and red-eyed, because for those of us that are colorblind, this works. Okay. So if we peel off all of the slow velocities and just leave the fast velocity perturbations showing here. Again, here's the boot of Italy, and here's Sicily. It looks very much like Italy, but also this shape, kind of a J shape, and it looks like there's this continuous subducted slab when you're looking at it from the top. However, it's very much not a continuous feature. And if we turn it on edge, so north, again, is in this direction. Here's the coastline. Here's Sicily. Rome would be located here. You can see that this slab is very discontinuous, and it's not a solid feature that we often see in textbooks. And so I'm going to show some better or maybe improved ways to try to image what the subducted slab looks like, not using seismic tomography, because of course you've learned in the tutorial so far that you can get quite a smeared picture of the edges of where these fast velocity zones are located. And so we're going to look at some alternative methods for doing just that. So the method I'm going to be talking about was one that Sane presented, I think, in the first lecture, very briefly, talking about waveform imaging and looking at multipathing of seismic waveforms. But we're also going to be looking at the frequency content that we just see in the raw data. So looking at the broadband seismograms, you can actually see these types of features, similar to what Guy showed us last week, that you can look just at the waveforms or very simple calculations, and then you can actually see the differences in the structure in the mantle below. So this work was motivated by some earlier papers, one with Jeff Abers worked on in Alaska, and also Furumura and Kennett in 2005 for Japan. So you often need very dense arrays of of seismometers out to be able to see some of these structures. But the characteristics that we see of looking at slabs, so seeing slabs in the deep in the mantle, is and deep earthquakes that occur within those slabs, is that we see a long duration coda after the P wave, and high frequency arrivals after that first P wave, and that first P wave also has a long period first arrival, so it's kind of a broad pulse, and then we have very high frequency signal in the coda afterwards. And this high frequency signals are only present in deep earthquakes, okay? So ones that are generally 100 kilometers or deeper. And they come up from the deep mantle within the slab, and you can use the, those characteristics to be able to tell whether that that energy is traveling within the slab. And so most studies, they see these observations, think that there are small-scale heterogeneities within the oceanic lithosphere, that those seismic waves are traveling up, that are aligned with slab dip and a crustal waveguide. So I'll go through these observations throughout the rest of the talk. Okay, so seismicity in the central Mediterranean is quite a good place to try to do this. Of course, Japan's fantastic, but that had been done before. Alaska was done by Jeff Fabers, and we're also trying to do that a little bit there, but that work is far too preliminary to show. But here's seismicity in the central Mediterranean, so I just pulled all these earthquakes from 1970 until now for magnitude 3.5 and greater. And you can see there are deep earthquakes there. There's not a whole lot for that's, you know, however 40-something years of earthquakes. There are deep ones there, but not a lot of it. But there are a good Benioff zone, so we can use those types of data. The triangles are all the INGV, the permanent network stations that are in Italy. And so we'll use these data, or have used these data, to try to capture some of these, infer some of the structure of the mantle beneath. Okay, so if we go back to this P-wave tomography model, I'm going to show two stations, this one that's in central Italy, and then one here that's in Sicily. And so this one is above where we don't infer slab structure from P-wave tomography, so it's all of those ISO contours have been pulled away. And then this one is right above the subducted Calabrian slab here. And so if we look at those two plus many other data, hopefully I can convince you that this is a nice technique to look and infer slab structure and mantle heterogeneity.
What's the depth scale on that?
This one is down to 400, so 450, I think. All right, so here's a map of Italy, and each of those red triangles are the same all the triangles on the INGV network. We're going to look at these two stations, this one in central Italy, and then this one just is actually in Calabria, not in Sicily, but right above the Calabrian arc. So just from first glance at these two different stations, you can see that the seismograms have a very different characteristic. So this is for this one deep earthquake located here within the slab at almost 300 kilometers depth. And so the seismic waves that are traveling up the Calabrian slab, up that fast velocity, velocity anomaly recorded the station cell have very high frequency content. So just by eye, you can see that there's a lot of tighter spaced wiggles, but the ones that are here are much broader. Okay, so you don't preserve that high frequency content. And then at each of these stations, we've plotted about 12 seconds from the P arrival, or just before the P arrival, showing the frequency content for all of those for that earthquake. So you can just very quickly see that there's a lot of high frequency content down here, not very much in the middle, and then we get some more high frequency content up here to the north. For guidance, we see that these are the bounds of the tear inferred from this tomography that I showed you before in the blue lines, and the purple lines are just where we see a cutoff, where we've drawn those in between where the lack of high frequency signals are and where high frequency signals are, just to guide your eye. Okay, so
they're all the same kind of instrument.
It's all been corrected.
Okay. Wow.
That's cool. So then we can take it a step further. So looking again at those two same stations, but now looking at the spectral amplitude between these two. So here's the spectrum for that station here, and then for this station here, and you can see very quickly it's very, very different. And then the red is a smooth spectrum based upon these two. So instead of just looking at the wiggles, we can plot the ratio between 7.5 hertz and 1 hertz to get a kind of color map of where we see this, where we see these high frequencies. And so the blues and greens are where we see. Yep.
Is the amplitude on all these seismograms the same? The vertical scale.
Yes, so they've all been normalized by taking out the instrument response. So that was kind of Ed's question. So
why is the vertical axis on the right then so small? Even at long periods, the amplitude is much smaller. The raw seismogram doesn't look that way.
Yeah, so how close they are between the station and where they're. So if it's traveling farther, it's going to have a smaller amplitude as well. Right, so this the how long the they travel through.
Also depends on the radiation pattern of the source, which azimuth the stations are located.
Did that answer your question? Not really. I can see your face.
The amplitude on the right in the seismogram looks the same. The power spectrum
the
on the bottom.
The seismograms are normalized for plotting.
Oh, that's the question I asked.
Okay, there we go.
So the vertical scale is different.
Yes. Okay, yes. That's fine. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so now we're plotting the ratio between these two, and so now we get a color map that shows where we get these high frequencies recorded at these instruments. So the blues and greens are where we have the high frequency, and the reds is where they are lacking. Okay, so then we get this nice pattern that shows the high frequency coming up from, that's recorded from this earthquake coming straight up the slab through the fast velocity anomaly, and these are the ones that are traveling through the normal mantle where we don't have slab, and then these ones again are going, starting to go through the slab because it is continuous farther to the north in Italy. Okay, but we can do, you know, do some modeling and synthetics to further investigate this, so it's very clear where we know where the slabs are and where it isn't, but what is actually in the slab that's causing these signals. Okay, so Abers and Sarker suggested that there's a waveguide from a low velocity layer at the top of the slab in Alaska, and that acts as a waveguide because it's very low velocity, and then the seismic waves travel up that, that waveguide, and then you can get a very strong peak in the seismogram. Okay, so we did modeling. So this is the data from that same event here, just looking at a few stations that are shown as the blue triangles here. And then here is our synthetics when we have just this low velocity on the top of the slab. So we're using the tomography model that I showed you before for the velocity structure to create the synthetics. Okay, so here's the data, here's the synthetics based upon the tomography model, but also adding in this low velocity layer. And this low velocity layer is 1 kilometer thick at the top of the slab, and inside this low velocity layer is a 5% velocity decrease. Sorry, they should both be negative. So negative 5% and negative 10% lower than the surrounding mantle. And this is where we get those signals from that low velocity layer. Okay, still doesn't look much like the data at all, but if we put in all of the structure within the slab, so here's a low velocity layer shown in red here, and if we create this random pattern of elongated structure within the slab, we can then create something that looks very, very much more like the data itself. Okay, and so these constraints show that we have an 80 kilometer thick slab, and we have these elongated little thing features, laminar type structure that are 10 kilometers in length and half a kilometer thick, and they're randomly scattered throughout the entire 80 kilometer thick lithosphere.
When you add that energy,
you still need the velocity. Yes, you do. So you need to be able to get this peak that comes in here and here. So you need both.
Yes. Can you figure out if all of this is in the lithospheric mantle, or if some of it is also in the crust?
Yes, that's a good question. So we need both, right? So we need this low velocity layer, which is in the crust, but we need all of this to continuous throughout the entire slab, and it's random. So if we tried to put in many different layers, it doesn't work nearly as much. And of course, we tried different thicknesses and different aspect ratios for all this laminar type structure, and varied the velocity contrasts as well to try to match it. And these other elongated velocity heterogeneities had been found by other groups as well. And this is only in 2D, and it's only using the P wave, and that's basically for computational reasons at this point. Okay, and then just because last week Guy talked about R, I thought I'd throw this plot in. So we're still use this ratio R, which is this factor of the d log Vs over d log Vp. And so we also did some more synthetics using SH, and so not the P waves, but looking at the horizontally polarized S waves to try to match the data by using the scaling factor R. And so remember that Guy told us that the regular mantle is 1.6. And so if we just had a thermal difference, we would expect it to be 1.6. But we have a preferred R value of 2.5, which is quite large. And melt from experimental work, the R value should be about 2.3. Okay, so it's quite high, but this provides a fairly good fit to the data. And note that this larger R value only extends the not only extends the time of the high frequency coda that's coming in, but also includes this low period arrival here that's also required to match the data. Okay, so what are these things? This is a good question. It's still kind of an open question. We do interpret that these laminar structure was formed during the formation of the oceanic lithosphere, that it's not happening during subduction or prior to subduction. And so the orientation of the stress field and the pathways to fluid and melt flow during subduction are unlikely to be slab parallel, like we see in these. And the formation of this residual mantle column at the ridge, there's abundant melt in the cenosphere. And so we think that due to local shear stresses, and the melt segregates and produces these melt-rich bands. And so these, we think, are preserved as bands or channels within the slab. But how that really works, not really sure. And so it's kind of an open-ended question of what are these really? Any questions on Italy? I'll move on to Morocco.
What was the strength of the variations? I forgot.
5 and 10%.
Okay.
Yeah, 5 p.m.
Is there any hint of similar structures at ridges that have been well studied by ridge projects?
That's a great question. So not really to my knowledge, but I don't think we really have the data to be able to infer that. Zach?
I guess I have two questions. One is, given the structures that you're inferring, did you take a look at anisotropy?
No, not yet. Yes, so that's another good question.
And the second is, you had very large differences in the spectral slopes. So did you compute the T star? And
no, we haven't done that. Because
you can measure absolute attenuation from those. And the difference was huge. So it would be interesting to see if it was, you know, at all commensurate with what we think the asthenosphere should look like.
That's a very good point. All right, so now I'm going to move a little bit farther west to the Western Mediterranean. So this is a Picasso experiment. We had 86 broadbands out, and another 21 from Munster and Bristol that covered from Spain to Morocco. And that was to mostly look at the mantle structure, of course, in this area. So seismicity in the Western Mediterranean isn't nearly as frequent as it is in Italy and elsewhere, but there are some deep earthquakes. You can see a couple of purple dots right here. There's basically nothing between 150 and then down to 600, but there are a couple, and we were very, very lucky to record this 617 kilometer deep event located here. And this is also, Sana had also talked about this earlier, that it's been used for all sorts of inferring structures for the entire Earth for everywhere because there's they don't happen very often. About every 50 years or so, we get one. Okay, and our whole array wasn't out, but this was the footprint that we had out at the time. And then I'm going to talk about this structure, a couple different structures here. One to note is that we have quaternary basalts in the middle atlas located here. And so we looked at the waveforms from this one deep event. So again, same idea, but now we're going to look at mostly just the SH data. I'm not going to talk about the P data here. So this is the shear waves, horizontally polarized. So now, if we look at all these little bumps, this is this first arrival, the S arrival, and this is the predicted time, this dotted line from AK135, which is another 1D model, a different one than PREM. And so you can see a couple things. One is that there's this big change, a big sharp jump in the travel time, so you expect it to line on the red dotted line here. It's they're early here, so arriving before, that means they're fast, and then after that, they're much more delayed, and that's between these two stations, PM21 and PM22. Also see another arrival that's on this dotted line located here, and for anybody that doesn't look at waveforms all the time, you wouldn't notice that at all, but that little bump, which I've highlighted with a line, is a second arrival, so there's something else coming in at that time, meaning you have to, the seismic waves have to hit some sort of structure to be able to get this extra bump in the wiggles here. And so this is the second arrivals that have a move out with distance as you get farther and farther away. Okay, and so to model these, we did a similar thing to what we did in Italy. We used the P-wave tomography model of Bezzotta et al., which was part of this Picasso project. And then we modeled this earthquake and the waves as they're going traveling up to the surface beneath Morocco, and then generated synthetics to try to match those data. Okay, so again, same record section showing you the S waves and then this extra little bump that's coming in later here. So this is just using that tomography model, generating synthetics, and these are the wiggles that you get out. You do get a bit of a change at that distance range from arriving early to arriving later, and that's because the waves that are traveling through the through the slab arrive sooner, and the ones that aren't arrive later. But we're not actually getting the second arrival later on. Okay, so there's nothing here. So we need to do something a little bit more. So now use the tomography model, but we also make it sharper, okay? So this is a subducted slab here, rather than that big, broad, blobby thing. We make it very, very sharp, but we also need this very low velocity zone beneath the Atlas Mountains, which is where the volcanoes are located. So we put in this 2D velocity model, then generate the synthetics again. Here's the data. Now we're getting this big jump in time, but now you can clearly see that second bump that's coming in, so it's that second arrival, and it has the correct move out compared to the data here. And so we ran synthetics with various different velocity reductions in that low velocity zone, and our best fit model is a decrease of 6% in VS beneath the Atlas Mountains to be able to generate that second move out there, which is right below where the volcanoes are located. Okay, and we can do it a little bit more. It's not just this little block. We actually could change the shape of what that low velocity zone looks like in the mantle, and it has to have this conduit type structure and then pooling underneath the Atlas Mountains, so it's in this direction. In this entire area here. And you can't really infer that from the P-wave tomography because it's a little bit too shallow to get very good resolution. And then we also looked at different data, not just that one deep event beneath Spain, but we looked at teleseismic S and SKS, and to better constrain the dip of this conduit structure beneath the Atlas Mountains. But the one that I really wanted to talk to you about is not just this low velocity zone, but this new work that we're working on now that continues on from this, is that we need a thin low velocity layer. So this was included in the model that showed this low velocity zone, but we need this another LVL, low velocity zone, but now you can see it here. Okay, so you can see it quite clearly here, and we cannot fit any of the data without this low velocity zone to produce the guided waves that the Abers et al. Had found and that we found in Italy. Yeah.
What is a low velocity little tube-like thing?
Stay tuned. Hang on. So this is what we need it here. But as Lesia noticed, and you should notice, it looks like it's on the bottom of the subducted slab. Okay, but hang on. We need that to be able to get the data to fit the synthetics, to fit the data. So here, this early arrival is the energy that's being radiated away from the slab and not going up the slab. But we also need we need this section here, which are these here, to be able to fit these extra bumps, again, in these little wiggles, to be able to get these extra bumps and a delayed arrival and this high-frequency coda afterwards, just like what we saw in Italy for the ones that are going up this lab. To be able to get those, we need this low-velocity zone, but the low-velocity zone needs to be what appears to be on the base of the mantle. And of course, there is a strong trade-off between the velocity contrast and the thickness of the low-velocity zone, but we think we've got it worked out. In addition to the low velocity zone, the other thing that we need is a very, very, very low velocity zone just around where the hypocenter is of the earthquake. And so this is shown in this red block here. So this is this low velocity layer that looks like it's on the bottom of the slab, but we also need this low velocity chunk right around where the hypocenter is going, because we get a converted P to S wave at that interface between this very low velocity zone and the rest of the subducted slab. Okay, and to get those second arrivals, these are these converted phases here. There's some on the second wiggles that we get as a PP and a SP conversion here. And this is all the stacked data. So this is the real data all stacked together from all the seismograms that I was showing you before. And then these are the synthetics shown in red for these varying synthetic models for a very, very slow, a minus 40% decrease in S waves down to minus 10. So we think that we have a velocity decrease between 20 and 30% to best fit. So we need these to be able to get these extra peaks that we see in the seismogram. And that region here has to be 5 kilometers, so it's very, very small, 5 kilometers, and the low velocity layer is only 1.5 kilometers, and it's continuous all the way from the top of the slab all the way down to to 640. We put it all the way down to 660. So it's something that's 1.5 kilometers thick and it extends all the way down. And what we can take away from that, oh, I think I just said all of that. So here's this. This is right at here, and so that low velocity zone needs to continue all the way up to the top of the slab. So what is that right where the earthquakes are nucleating? But the other important thing is that this origin of the low velocity layer shows that the slab must be rolled over. Okay, so normal slab subduction in this direction goes down like this, but we think it's rolled over all the way on top, so it's basically on over. Yeah.
Well, he's excited.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this low velocity layer, maybe it's formed by the hydration of the oceanic lithosphere, maybe it's kryptonite, I don't know. But we think we're actually documenting rolling over of the slab as it hits the transition zone. And it's this tiny little slab, I didn't talk about that too much, but it's only a couple hundred kilometers wide. So it's not, like the Pacific slab that's all the way going down. It's just this last little bit of the Tethys Ocean that's descending into the mantle. And there's hardly any more earthquakes occurring, but they keep occurring in that very low velocity layer and that little bit at the base of the slab. Over time, but that's what I wanted to talk about there, and then some other time we can talk about the Banda arc.
What's the rupture plane of the earthquake look like?
Yeah, good question. So we've been working on that, and it seems to be a little bit different than what the published mechanism was, which was by Bizzotta and Jim Humphreys. So it seems to be a little bit different, but yeah, it's really difficult to try to figure out. But you can see the rupture propagation differences if you look at the stations that are to the north versus to the south.
I was just thinking of some relationship between the earthquake itself and that low velocity earthquake producing it.
Do you need metastable olivine? For the, I mean, for the seismic velocity structure,
yeah,
the type of anomalies that you get.
Yeah, I'm not qualified to answer that question.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I have no idea about what the petrology, the geochemistry, what you could...
You would just basically be thinking about the difference between an olivine and a ringwoodite at that depth, in
yeah.
terms of what the predicted seismic velocity difference would be.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Can I comment on that? I mean, for a mesible argon wrench, it's in the center of the slab, right?
Well, I bet the thermal anomaly looks different than what you're capturing with that low velocity anomaly. Because, yes, otherwise it would just be too hot to have the rupture happen there.
And it's right at the top of the slab, right? It's not deep within the interior of the slab. That's what's interesting.
How well constrained is that? I mean, you really have that the velocity structure.
Yeah,
and you have to super low velocity and then normal
yeah.
the side.
Yeah. Yeah. So it can't be in like the center of it, which is again also very interesting. Which is why I don't understand.
Okay.
The epic lesion.
Yeah, well, just follow up on that, basically. Actually, personally, I have my own model of like the mechanics of deep earthquake. I basically propose is the crust, oceanic crust, and the mantle form a shear zone. That's why earthquake. Nuclei at the very surface of the slab and such. So that seems to be consistent with my
work.
Can you go back? So I love the, this is really exciting. Go back a little more and a little more. Okay, that. So this, putting in this thin, low velocity layer produces these secondary arrivals in the SH data. But can you now go back a few more?
Yeah.
So in the P data, I want to see, what do you see in the P data? I think you showed P data, okay.
So here's P, yeah. But we haven't been able to model it because of the computational cost.
Yeah, but that look more extended. Yeah, that's cool. Awesome. Because the P would care even more.
Yes.
Very cool. And maybe at higher frequencies. Have you looked at this at higher frequencies? Do you see the same stuff that you see in Calabria?
No, we haven't gone any higher than this, and I can't remember what the band, obviously we could have bandpassed it, we haven't done any of this. Mm-hmm.
So the imaging with this array has also shown that this slab is continuous
yes.
all the way down, because some people have like modeled the
yeah,
model.
So it's, maybe this shows it. Yeah, so here you can kind of see it. It seems to be continuous up to Morocco and then discontinuous from Spain. And this is, so the top parts, top 60 kilometers is the surface wave results. And so, but you can see a conversion in the receiver function data there where it looks like it's still connected beneath Morocco, but it's disconnected beneath Spain. And so we were modeling it as if it was coming up obviously beneath Morocco and is continuous all the way to the top.
So I'm curious about how deep this low velocity layer can go into the metal.
To extend it to depth, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all the way through to the slab. So all the way as far as we can see the slab. So here it's about 600. We put it to 660 kilometers.
Okay. Because I think it could be potentially the layer with sediment. Is it true?
No. That's. Could be your project, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, which is why I kind of wanted to show some of this. But that's, yeah, but is it sediment? Can that really go down to, and it's, you know, it's but it's so thin, so you'd think that maybe it is sediment, but it's only, so in Calabria, it's 4 kilometers thick, and then here it's 1.5. And then the, from memory, though, the one in Japan is about 5 kilometers thick, this waveguide. Yeah, good question.
So, it is actually puzzling. You have a low velocity outer surface of the slab. I mean, just a dumb question, really dumb question. Is this, do we know this is for sure oceanic slab or can be a continental slab? Can
yeah.
you cross it so?
Yeah, oh, no, it's definitely because it's a Tethys Ocean.
So it is an
yeah.
oceanic slab.
Yep, absolutely.
Great, okay, thanks, Megan.